Hello, comrades. Welcome to our Sunday meeting hosted by the Consistent Democrats. Today we've got two items on the agenda. Ian is going to talk for about 20 minutes on Iraq, US, and the general geopolitics question. And then we're going to have a discussion on that for a bit. And then in the second part of the agenda, Ian's going to lead a talk on the local elections that we've recently just had. And then we'll have an agenda, and then we'll have a discussion on those items. Okay, Comrade Ian, the floor is yours. Take it away.
Okay, thank you, comrades. Yeah, there's a strong possibility of a resumption in the war with Iran in the next week or so by the US and Israel, simply because the US and Trump himself cannot admit defeat. But I don't think it's going to make any difference to the outcome, because the Trump regime is struggling to come to terms with its being defeated, and Iran is too strong militarily with its drones, its missiles, and the missile defense it's now imported and reinforced from China and Russia to be defeated in a conventional war. And it appears that however much latitude the US ruling class has given Trump in waging this war, it doesn't want the use of nuclear weapons against Iran. And the reason is very simple, because it would lead to retaliation against Israel, at least, with nuclear weapons. Russia and Pakistan, North Korea, and implicitly even China have said this to Trump in so many words, either behind the scenes or even in some cases in public. So Trump talks big and he makes big threats repeatedly, but he's been deprived of the nuclear option by his own generals, who in practice he's unable to sack. And because of the potent possibility, actually, of a coup, you can surmise, that's why he can't really sack them. You know, so there is, I don't think there's much he can do at the moment. And in conventional terms, even more bombing would make no difference. And ground troops would be a farce. So, in fact, Trump has been forced to declare that his Operation Epic Fury, which some call Epstein's Fury, is over, and it failed. Killing Ali Khamenei simply unified the Iranian population behind the government and the setup of the Islamic Republic, and it politically backfired pretty much immediately, as did the bloodthirsty attack on the girls' school on the first day of the war. And now, as for so-called Project Freedom, breaking the blockade of Hormuz by force, that's a bigger joke. It was spiked by two things. One was the Iranian attack on the UAE's oil refinery that's in the Sea of Oman, outside the Strait of Hormuz, and that caused a huge fire at that refinery, and possibly even wrecked the capacity of the UAE to actually export oil through that area for a long time. And the other is the closure of US airspace to the US, which I think was a direct result of the attack on the UAE, the preemptive attack of the UAE by Iran, which made it, you know, I mean, this has arisen before, including in the Yemen war, you know, a good few years ago now, that Saudi Arabia is very sensitive, understandably so, for the possibility that its oil facility can be bombed and eliminated. And that is the thing that's posed by what's going on today and any attempt to relaunch this war. You know, I mean, from the standpoint of US imperialism, this is actually a strategic defeat, because it's lost a whole bunch of its bases in the Gulf. And they're mincemeat. They've already been, you know, destroyed or semi-destroyed. Whether or not there's any residual presence or not, they don't work. From the point of view of the rational interests of US imperialism, this, you could say this is an unnecessary defeat and a disaster And it's the biggest disaster the US has suffered since the fall of Saigon in 1975. And yet, unlike the fall of Saigon, which was the completion of an incomplete social revolution, Iran was not, and it is not, necessarily an opponent of US imperialism. It would have been quite prepared to play along with US imperialism, and we've seen this in past events. Because the demolition of Iran is a Zionist project. Israel has the project of demolishing every significant non-servile state in the region, and it's had that policy since virtually since its foundation in 1948. It actually had Suez, which drew Britain and France in 1956 to do its dirty work. You know, and then the United States was actually opposed to it. But as this sort of Jewish Zionist cult grew to prominence in the US in the 70s, things changed. I mean, in the 1967 war, Israel defeated Egypt, Syria, etc. But it really depended upon French military hardware mainly for doing so, Mirage jets and things, you know. But by 1973, it had nukes, and it threatened to use them against Egypt. Apparently, this has come out now. It threatened to use nuclear weapons against Egypt in the 1973 war to blackmail the United States into rushing it the conventional means to actually win the Yom Kippur War. And this is why you had this nuclear alert that Richard Nixon put the U.S. strategic forces on nuclear alert during the Yom Kippur War, because Israel had actually threatened to use nukes. This has come out quite recently. Now, the Israel lobby became increasingly powerful in the United States in the 70s and the 80s. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it managed to somehow fill a political vacuum in bourgeois politics. Because, you know, with the so-called death of communism, what was there left to fight for the U.S. Military industrial complex and the military apparat, you know? And what became the enemy was Muslims, basically, the Muslim peoples, particularly in the Middle East. You have this clash of civilizations thesis, which conveniently dovetails with the Zionist agenda, as I was talking about, the projects of demolishing all Israel's competitors in the Middle East. You know, it's a greater Israel, effectively, you know. So you have a straight line from the 1991 Iraq War, and then the 2003 destruction and invasion and destruction of Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Then you have Libya in 2011. Then you have Syria, which began in the same year, I think, and it took over a decade to destroy Assad's government. But, you know, but basically it paralyzed it and bogged a strategic opponent of Israel down in this conflict, which eventually it lost for nearly a decade and a half, you know. And then the culmination of this is this war with Iran. It was all warned of, in a way, by the, as I pointed out before, by what's his name, Ramsey Clark, who basically publicised what the intention of the Zionists and the US neocons was. I think he publicised that in 2007, you know, and he wasn't a supporter of it. He exposed it for a reason, but it didn't really make much difference. But anyway, the world situation has now changed, and we see the rise of Russia and China as allied world powers, with Iran as their potent ally, which it really is, you know. So Israel has now overreached itself, and it's, you know, its potent influence on the US politics, as Trump is effectively their hireling, has led to the US overreaching itself as well. I mean, the US has been in relative decline for a long time, but the these neocon Israeli wars, this is the wars that Trump was elected supposedly to put an end to, you know, which is the another aspect of that contradiction. It's accelerated the decline of US imperialism, these wars have. And Israel has also failed. Because if its great power protector is defeated, then Israel itself suffers a kind of a strategic defeat, you know. And that's in spite of its genocide in Gaza and the genocidal war in Lebanon as well, you know. Its attack on Iran was a failure. Israel itself was twice very severely bombarded and effectively defeated by Iranian strategic conventional but hypersonic missiles and drones and things, you know. And it's being defeated in Lebanon also, and it wants the US to keep fighting. But it's all in vain, really, you know. That Israel itself is in deep trouble, and there is talk of Israel disintegrating when Netanyahu is forced out, you know. Whether this is true or not remains to be seen, but even Haaretz, which is the paper of the what liberal bourgeoisie there is in Israel, is talking about that when Netanyahu goes, the state may be destroyed. You know, so this is a strategic defeat for both the US and Israel, and it is breaking the relationship between Israel and the US. You know, on both sides of the political divide in the US, you see hostility to the Israel lobby growing. Among MAGA, obviously you see the such people as Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson and others, you know, who were staunch supporters of Trump, have bailed out and are now some of the most outspoken critics of Trump and opponents of Trump, you know. But it's happening to the Democrats as well, because you've seen that the people who, it used to be the case until fairly recently, that IPAC could actually destroy virtually anybody they chose by using their money and their financial weight and their, you know, the publicity machine they've got to destroy people in primaries who stood against Israel or were in any way critical of Israel. But now it's the opposite way round. And what's happening in some Democratic primaries is that people who are identified as being funded or associated with IPAC, etc., are being treated as pariahs and are losing massively, because that thing has turned into its opposite. It's turned from a blessing into a curse, into a sort of kiss of death, you know. So I think this opens up potential space. I know we've got a terrible situation with Trump's regime attempting to rig elections, its attacks on the migrant populations, the ICE terror, all these things, and of course the killings of people like Rennie Good and Alex Pretty in Minneapolis, and there could well be others, you know. All these things are terrible, but there is a huge potential for working class politics to emerge in the United States because of this disaster, I think, you know. And, you know, we see the creation of a kind of anti-imperialist bloc internationally, you know. What we need to do, what really is strategic task of communists, is to build a communist component of this, to actually build a communist party or an international communist initiative of some kind that can inject socialist communist politics into the anti-imperialist blocs that are going on. And that's what we try to do, insofar as we have very small means, but we are working with others in that regard. In things like IUAFS and the Anti-Fascist International, etc. Anyway, I'll leave it there. I'll open it up for discussion. I said I would make quite a short contribution today, and we'll open it up for discussion. Thank you, comrades.
Thank you, Ian. I remind comrades that we are being recorded, and that we keep our contribution to one at a time. Please can you indicate when you wish to speak? Those on camera, you can just use your real hand and I'll be able to see those that aren't, can you use your virtual hand and then I'll call you to speak. Okay, who do you want to start? Hello, Max. Anyone? I have a feeling this item's going to be a fairly short debate here. Okay, well, I suppose if there's nothing come I want to say on this item, I can only suggest that we move on to the second part of the agenda. Shall we do that now then?
Sure, if people don't want to speak on this, I mean, I'm surprised about that, but no problem, yeah, if I can do that.
I think in some cases it might be a bit of a case of... John wants to speak. Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't know that Russia and China were threatening a nuclear response if Israel attack Iran, you know. I didn't know they're coming to Iran's defense, really. But I don't follow the news closely enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have heard that. I've heard that it's been explicitly said in private, but obviously it's been intimated publicly that Putin has said that a nuclear attack on Iran would lead to a nuclear attack on Israel, you know. And that other people have made it even more clear. I mean, Kim Jong-un has made it pretty clear, you know. the stuff has been said by Pakistani politicians as well. But the one that's implicit is China. And I think that's more been said through diplomatic channels and implied than actually, you know, publicised, but I think it's still there. It was my understanding anyway. I mean, there are different analysts around who talk about these things, but that's my understanding of the situation.
Hello, Mark. Go ahead.
Cheers. Yeah, of course, the overriding aspect, which is very rare for any country's leadership in the face of American aggression, is where does the leverage come from on their part? Well, of course, the leverage they do have over Israel is the fact that the Iranian military know where the desalination plants are.
Mm-hmm.
And they could deprive Israel of fresh water, you know, in a day. And so they still have that. And of course, the Israeli government will be more than aware of that, which is probably why they haven't pushed it themselves as far as they can, or as far as they could, because they know the recriminations, which refers to the last point being made. They know how deadly they could be for themselves. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Hello, Susan. Ian, do you want to come back on that?
No, I'll let anybody else speak who wants to speak.
Okay. Does anyone else want to come in?
Apologies for being late. Sorry, Mark, are your hands still up?
I think that's a legacy hand.
Okay. My understanding is, while there's a lot of leverage from China and Russia to ask Iran not to escalate, they are quite clear that they support them fully in retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're seeing at the moment is, yes, America's blockading Iran's partial filtration, shall we say, of what goes through the Hormuz Strait. It's not blockaded at all. It's just they're not letting Israel and America and the countries which are attacking them through. They're letting through everyone else. And America's upset because that means all these other countries are going through, but they can't. And for a supremacist nation, that really upsets them. But the leverage on Iran is they don't want a global catastrophe, which all the governments are upset about. But they do want to make Israel stop. And since America will not stop Israel, Iran is the country of which is the only country capable at the moment of stopping Israel. And Israel is threatening America with they're going to use nuclear weapons. So it is a standoff, but it's very time limited because America's main problem is they've got the midterms coming up. And Australia, Trump will not survive losing in both houses, which if you look at what reform did to Labour this week, then the chances that Trump will lose both houses and therefore face the same threat of imprisonment that Netanyahu has been facing. And Netanyahu keeps ramping up the war and... So they're all in a bind, which sooner or later is, you know, it's a bubble that's going to burst. But the, Russia and China are very clear that it is not going to allow Israel to continue this smash and grab. I've been heartened by the fact that Lebanon is fighting back after every betrayal. And France and Germany, and I suspect... I suspect Britain is carrying the fight. I think it's much more complicated, but I'm really sorry if you've...
Let me deal with it.
Mark, can you mute yourself?
I've
got a bit of interference. Go ahead.
That'll be my voice.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, Susan, go ahead.
No, it was only to say, I think we're sort of all... We're all waiting for something to happen, but I think that the bigger thing is going to be how long can America, certainly how long can Israel wait for Netanyahu to, Netanyahu won't quit, but between, you know, they, we know how long US and Israel can wait, and it's actually a much shorter time than the midterms, but it will be over by the midterms. They seem to be doing something with rigging postal votes at the moment, which I'm pretty sure is what the Tories did, you know, in previous elections. Have you seen anything about that,
Ian?
Well, just on that, I mean, the Trump administration is desperately trying to rig the midterms, and the gerrymandering stuff is going on. Some of this stuff is problematic because some of it is state. You know, the Constitution clearly states it's in the hands of states, and Trump is trying to federalize things that he has no business doing in terms of the constitutional power of the president. So yep. I think, even the Supreme Court, which is his baby to a very large extent, has difficulty in intervening on some of these things because they are so clear that these are state matters and it would take a constitutional amendment to change that, you know. And he's not going to get a constitutional amendment. And the Supreme Court can do some things, but it can't do everything for him, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I think he may well lose despite his gerrymandering stuff in the autumn, because he is so unpopular now. He's on the verge of the sort of unpopularity of George W. Bush in approximately 2007, 2008, which produced the Obama landslide, you know, which was a huge, you know, it was a huge landslide because Bush's popularity was down in the 20s. I think Trump's approval rating is about 32% at the moment, and it's on the way down further, you know. he's approaching the point where even the gerrymandering might not stop the GOP being swamped in the midterms, which I think is highly likely, to be honest. And there's the other possibility. There are people who want to resign from the House of Representatives in the manner of Marjorie Taylor Greene, who already resigned from the House of Representatives, in order to force by-elections, which will basically fuck the majority that he's got in the lower house, at least, before they get to the midterms, which will be interesting if that does happen. There are people in MAGA people who have there are people who regard Trump as a traitor, basically, to everything he said, you know, to everything he said to get elected, because he was elected on the promise that he would stop the neocon wars. He would stop these repeated forever wars. And he's just started the biggest one of all, you know, because it's also the most ruinous, because it's fucked almost from the very beginning. I mean, it took a long time for George W. Bush to lose the Iraq war. And in some ways, he didn't lose it until after he'd left office, although, you know, it was a disaster. But it wasn't quite such a military disaster as this. Because the US is not actually in the US is not in Iran, and it's being held at bay. It's basically can't approach more than 1,000 kilometers within Iran. It's missile, it's ships and things, because they fear the power of Iranian missile firepower. You know, so I don't know. I mean, there are people. You see, the Democrats are divided, and there are people at the base of the Democrats who want to break with Israel. You know, there are people. You know, obviously, the Democratic Party leadership is staunchly pro-Zionist, as Biden showed. But there is huge contradictions at the base, so I don't know what will happen. You know, I really don't know. John wants to speak.
I'm just thinking. I mean, Max will know about all this, but just an aside on how bourgeois politics does affect us and is important. I know on the Supreme Council there was a Democrat woman who was on the Supreme Council. On the Supreme Court. And during the Obama presidency, she was asked to stand down twice so that they could put some younger Democrat in, which, of course, would have been better for us, you know. I mean, I know, you know, they could argue, but it could have been. And she refused. She refused to stand down. And Obama asked her twice. And then, of course, she passed away. They put a right-wing Republican, when Trump got in, he put a right-wing Republican in her place on the Supreme Court. So the point is that these things do affect us and do have an effect. I don't know what position we should take on that, but it would be better for the left if Democrats were on the Supreme Court, although we don't have any faith in the Supreme Court, sort of thing.
Well, I'll just say on that, I think we should be for abolishing the Supreme Court. You know. It's an anti-democratic institution, you know, created by slave owners and such like, you know. And anything that does such things should be popularly elected and should be recallable. You know, it's like all these things. We don't have any confidence in bourgeois democracy. We demand that all judges be subject to election and immediate recall, you know. And I think that's the political answer to it. We don't have any faith in these people. Mind you, in some cases, it's worse than others. I mean, these things, there is direct corruption in the, you know, Trump, people say that Trump owns the Supreme Court. And there's much truth in that, you know. because there has been a slippage into overt corruption since Trump's first term. In fact, before that, to be honest, he was only able to do that because of things like Citizens United and all the various subterfuges that originated under Bill Clinton, where people, all the restrictions on buying influence in politics were done away with, and that's Clinton. That's not Trump or even Bush. That was the Clinton administration, which was as neoliberal as any. There is no real difference. There are differences of nuance between the parties in the US. There's some differences of rhetoric and some differences of social base, because the Democrats have a base in organised labour, which the Republicans have a base among backward workers who are mainly not unionised. Although that's begun to change. But the Democrats were the party of the Popular Front, weren't they? That had an organised labour contingent, but it was subordinate to the bourgeoisie. Unlike the British Labour Party, because the British Labour Party is the party of the trade union bureaucracy. There is no fundamental difference between the parties. Although there are differences on policy between, the question of Zionism is actually instructive, because there are certain things that the Zionists were not satisfied with the obeisance of the Democratic Party under Obama and possibly even under Clinton to its objectives. So they sabotaged Obama's administration. Particularly, they agitated around the question of the Iran deal, and Netanyahu came to Washington and he spoke to a joint session of Congress, and he got 50 standing ovations or something like this. It was in 2015, and this was the sort of the part of the mobilization to get Trump elected, and so Trump could abolish Obama's Iran deal, which he, of course, he did. Everybody knows that Biden did actually make some token attempts to get the thing on the road again, but he never really managed it. And his heart was really in it. And of course, we know the situation with the genocide Joe during the period of the first part of the genocide, but he was still in office, Although there are things that Trump has done now that he wouldn't have been able to do, and that's things like this Board of Peace and all that sort of thing. I don't think that Biden would have been able to do that, because they don't have the same relationship with Israel, That's also the tactical differences. What about Ukraine versus Israel? What is the division? And it's basically this: the bulk of the American bourgeoisie thinks Russia is the main enemy, but there is a faction within it that thinks that Israel is the strategic, the strategic lodestar of, or should be, and that Russia isn't really the main immediate enemy. It's the enemies of Israel who are the enemy, and number one being Iran. So Trump prefers this war to the Ukraine war. That's a tactical difference, And I think that, Biden still was into, pressing on Ukraine all the time, on Russia and Ukraine. But Trump relaxed that in order to get. But he wasn't doing anything positive. He was actually just shifting from one theatre of war to another, on the basis of his particular obeisance to Israel. And I think that's all it was. It's a difference of tactics within US imperialism. There's nothing good about either. They are both vile. They're both enemies with slightly different tactics. That's my analysis of it, anyway.
Who else wanted to come in? We'll make this point the last point. If no one wants to come in, we'll go on to the next item on the agenda. And Okay, can we go ahead, Ian?
We'll close this point now and go on to the question of the local elections. And I do have a slightly longer contribution to the presentation on that, but it's not massively longer. And I will go on to that now, if that's okay with people, yeah?
Yeah, sorry, obviously I've missed whether you... Did you comment at all about the crypto fake money and the manipulation of the markets?
Not really, not particularly.
All right, because that has been shocking for the fact that, you know, while Trump is cheerfully tweeting away about the oil prices and we keep up this pretense of it's sort of about $100, in reality, the oil price, when the oil gets in the tanker and arrives, the futures market is actually, it's nearer to 200 and maybe, you know, they're talking about it going to twice that, at least. So, you know, the mask has been lifted off the extent to which the petrodollar is nothing like it is. But there was at the beginning of this a suspicion that Trump was desperately trying to devalue the dollar in order to be competitive. And he's basically destroying, yes, the economies of, you know, the UK and Europe, but he's also planning to devalue the dollar while keeping the petrodollar. That's why they're trying to maintain a hold on all of the pinch points. So that's Panama, Suez, the Straits of Hormuz, as well as the Baltic routes, to try and keep total control of the oil trade while devaluing the dollar. Mm. Have you got anything to say on that?
Well, not a huge amount, except it's obvious the cynicism of it, isn't it? I mean, people have made huge amounts of money out of these threats against Iran. They usually happen on a Saturday, not always, but usually on a Saturday, so they can create a panic over the weekend, and then towards the end of the Sunday, it backs down, so the markets can subside and he can make a big profit, or his people can make a profit over the when the markets reopen or something like that, you know.
Larry Johnson pointed out that actually all of the Venezuelan oil money is going into Trump's bank account. Yeah, it's actually not going back to America. You know, he is the most corrupt. He says he's the most corrupt president that America has ever had. And that the whole point about the, have you seen the demand that that the Straits of Hormuz, the money paid over for traveling through the Straits of Hormuz should be shared equally between America and Iran, and that Trump would collect that one as well. So we're talking about, you know, he would be a trillionaire, but even if he got kicked out in the midterms. And because if you look at how many billions he made on crypto and his, Trump coin before, I forget what they called that. What was the coin before it? You know, I mean, it's just one big Ponzi scheme after another. And AI is one of the biggest. That's why they also wanted the uranium. He's desperately going around the world trying to pinch not just gold reserves from countries, but the uranium as well.
Yeah.
But God knows what that's doing to our pension funds. I'm guessing that it isn't just going to be food prices we're going to have to worry about in the future.
Anyway, can we go on to should we go on to the next point? Yeah, I'll start my
presentation. Yep. The woes of the Your Party.
Okay, so results of the elections on May 7th. This is what this is partly about, you know. I mean, it's a very serious blow to Starmer's Labour leadership, though not yet terminal for the Labour Party as a whole, in my view. Although such terminal consequences are on the agenda in a slightly less immediate sense. Labour lost 1,239 seats, as I understand it, in the elections last Thursday, Major games were made by reform. Not that many councils, actually. Only about half a dozen, I think, but including one on the edge of London. They gained 1,384 seats. And significant gains were made by the Green Party, who gained 403 seats. The Tories lost 426 seats. But for Labour, this is similar to the kind of rout that the Tories suffered during the last government, with the end of Johnson and Truss and then Sunak, the various local election routs that they suffered. And they were heading for a much bigger crisis, as is the Labour Party. I don't think we're quite there yet, and they're going to try and stave it off in some way, I'm sure. You know, but the losses to reform are actually very significant. On the order of the sort of collapse of the Red Wall in 2019. But a significant number of these losses were to the Greens and not reform. And it's also true that a significant proportion of reform's gains were at the expense of the Tories, not Labour. So both of the major parties are therefore in retreat. Labour may have suffered. Labour ought to have suffered more than it did. You know, some of its losses to reform, which were considerable but not overwhelming, could have gone to a working class alternative if one had been standing. But unfortunately, in most cases, that wasn't true. And the reason this didn't happen is because the Greens are not a proper working class alternative. They're very far from it. They're a petty bourgeois radical party. And even though they've picked up a large layer of socialist militants who were disappointed by what's effectively the sabotage of your party, the core of the Green Party is middle class. And it's making a show of formulating a workers' charter, etc., to try and appeal to a working class audience, which is sort of gained by default because of what's happened to your party. It's not the real thing. Zach Polanski is very well spoken and articulate, and that's provoked a storm of ruling class libels and hysteria against it. They don't like being contradicted, but they contradict themselves. You know, they contradict themselves by screaming about anti-Semitism in the Green Party while publishing racially offensive caricatures of Zach Polanski, who happens to be Jewish, and there are pictures of him, cartoons of him with an enormous nose, which he hasn't got. You know, in the Times, in the Daily Telegraph, in the Daily Mail, and in the Sun, there are similar anti-Semitic cartoons of Polanski. You know, so I think we should defend him. You know, and in some ways, I think he's a more genuine person than some others. You know, he in his earlier history, he was soft on Zionism, and he actually denounced Corbyn for reactionary denunciation of Corbyn for being anti-Semitic, which he's now actually apologised for, amazingly enough. And I think the reason for that is not that some cynicism. I think basically he's become radicalised because of the Gaza genocide and changed his mind, and he's adopted a kind of anti-Zionist position, which looks genuine to me, you know. But he does not appear as a working class and socialist leader, because he isn't one, basically, you know. He's a left-talking petty bourgeois leader, a petty bourgeois radical, and therefore the Greens have quite a limited ability to appeal, if they have it at all, to appeal to the more angry and demoralised sections of the working class who are being driven to reform. And this is where the sabotage of the Zara Sultana initiative, the party, which we call your party, is telling. You know, it was willfully and maliciously sabotaged by Corbyn and the group around him. You know, I mean, your party's intervention in the local elections were few and far between. They only ran 25 official candidates in the whole country under the Your Party ticket, and many of those got derisory votes. The best that I know of was Mel Mullings in Thornton Heath, who got in Croydon, because I was very, very actively involved in her campaign. She got 327 votes when the winning Labour candidates got over 1,000, and so did the losing, the Greens, who just about lost, you know. So she was getting about a quarter of the votes of the main parties, which is not, which is respectable, but it's not obviously not winning a winning vote. And I think she got caught in the middle of a contest, of a battle royal between the Labour Party and the Greens in her constituency, and was marginalised as a result of that. But I mean, this was a hard fought campaign by a genuinely activist and socialist branch, and it was difficult to cut through that conflict between Labour and the Greens. But elsewhere, your party's refusal to run candidates has meant many independent left wing campaigns have run outside of the your party banner, but supported by your party itself in some cases, and they varied in their politics enormously. You see overtly socialist and left-wing groupings like the Southwark Independent Socialists or Haringey Socialist Alliance, or there's an independent groups of socialists in Coventry, including Grace Lewis, who didn't win, unfortunately, backed by Zara Sultana, whose seat is in Coventry, of course, you know. On the other hand, there are people like the Redbridge Independents, who are backed by Corbyn, and whose demands are just simply, there's nothing much socialist about them at all, even in terms of rhetoric. They just call for clean politics and against corruption and la 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 la, la, but there's nothing really working class or socialist about them. You know, they hardly mention it, and it's just left-wing populism, you know. That's all it is. To be fair, Corbyn did actually visit the Haringey Socialist Alliance on one occasion, and actually was filmed talking, you know, working with them on the streets at one point, you know. But he's refused to do the same with the people in Islington, in his own borough, you know. Because they're too left-wing, they're people associated with the grassroots left, you know. So I think that appearance was an attempt to deflect some of the criticism for this, you know. But none of it's accidental. None of this is accidental, really. It's clear from the sequence of events that Corbyn has been dissembling against calls for a new party for several years, since he was deprived of the Labour whip in 2020, you know, in the end of 2020, he was deprived of the Labour whip by Keir Starmer. And he's effectively had 5 years to get things on the road, you know, to create a new party, you know. And he's always very, it was always very clear that if he'd done it, he would have had mass support to do so, but he never did it, you know. He left it until the very last minute before deciding to stand as an independent in the 2024 general election. He had no choice but to do that, because Starmer had deprived him of the Labour whip, and he wouldn't have been allowed to stand as a Labour candidate in his seat that he's been there since 1983, you know. So he had to start. He had no choice but to get himself expelled for standing as an independent against the Labour Party to keep his seat. You know, he won, and it was always obvious that he was going to win. You know, and as an independent, he was part of a broader phenomena of independents who stood and won over Gaza. There were 5 of them. All the others are Muslim, sort of anti Zionist activists who were not specifically socialists necessarily, and in most of the cases they're not, you know. But he was not keen on the party, and you know, he always ummed and ahed and delayed. And the reason is very simple, because he hoped to get the Labour whip back at one point, you know, and having a new party. Building a new party is a huge obstacle to that. It makes it impossible. And it would still be, impossible for him. And it's interesting to note that if you look at Corbyn's parliamentary description, it says he's an independent MP even today. You know, if you look him up in Parliament, he says the independent MP for Islington North. So he's not a Your Party MP, whereas Zara Sultana is the Your Party MP for Coventry South or whatever it is. You know, Zara Sultana resigned from Labour with the express aim of founding a new left-wing party. And after some hesitation, quite a lot of hesitation, he agreed. And the reason he agreed was he was frightened of being marginalised if he refused, and it had gone on without him. And when it was mooted publicly and people were given the chance to express support for the idea, 800,000 people signed up in August 2025. And the thing is, it's obvious that Corbyn and his people, his various bureaucrats and such like around him, were frightened by the size of that response, 800,000. And they saw it as a comrade in Croydon who says they saw it as a monster, you know, as a threatening monster that could get out of control. And they delayed and delayed from trying to recruit these people. He named the party that they'd mooted. He took the unilateral action of naming it Your Party, supposedly as a placeholder name. So much for that, because that's what it's called. You know, there was a meeting of the various founding groups in early September 2025 about co-leadership, and there was a vote on it, and Corbyn lost the vote, apparently. So he basically withdrew from that committee and went back into organising around his own independent group of MPs. That is the other four who won in the general election. And as there is, you know, they just continue to stonewall on the question of launching a membership portal. So Zara Sultana launched a membership portal herself to implement what they'd been promised on September the 19th, 2025, and it signed up 20,000 people in 2 hours. And if it had been left to run, it would have actually signed up 100,000 in one day. That's my view. And, likely 500,000 in a week, and that's not unrealistic, because basically 800,000 had signed up for the original expression of interest, so it's highly likely it could have recruited 500,000. But after 2 hours, it was sabotaged by an email from Corbyn and his independents claiming it was a fraud, you know, and it wasn't a fraud. It was their email that was a fraud, you know, it was libelous as well, you know. So they launched, they managed to push that to one side, and a whole kerfuffle emerged about the money that had been taken from people who joined in good faith under the supposedly fraudulent portal, which wasn't fraudulent, but it was an exercise in trying to seize control of the data. So they launched another portal at the end of September under the control of Corbyn's thing called Peace and Justice, which is a non-socialist pressure group. And what it was really about was a data grab and a power grab to exclude Zara Sultana from real influence over the process. Because she'd made clear that she envisaged a party of the whole left, including Marxist groups. And she capitulated Corbyn's capitulation to Zionism. She criticised Corbyn's capitulation to Zionism when he was leader. And she spoke up for things, for policies like opposition to NATO, to Zionism, to transphobia, in favour of a policy of class war, for widespread nationalisations, for workers' control. She spoke up for all these things and made some very, very radical speeches in the period when the party was in formation. And Corbyn's bureaucracy, or the beginnings of it, did everything possible to rig the conference and the subsequent election to the Central Executive Committee against these left-wing policies, which were actually embodied in what was called the grassroots left slate during the CEC election campaign. They fought against that in favour of a tepid populism. But they lost crucial votes at the conference in November the 29th and 30th. In spite of that bureaucratic framework, they lost votes over socialism, over declaring it to be an explicitly socialist party. They lost the vote over dual membership of socialist groups. They lost the vote over collective leadership instead of an individual leader, i.e. Corbyn, you know. So what they did is they used the monopoly of data they'd seized to rig the elections to the CEC, using that monopoly to basically, there's a monopoly over the membership, which was only 55,000 by the time of the conference. They used that to bombard tens of thousands of those new members that the grassroots left, which is Zara's slate, and the independent candidates in the CEC election had no access to at all. They bombarded with propaganda. The election was supposed to be organised by an independent body, but it wasn't. It was organised by Carrie Murphy and her merry people, who basically fixed it. You know, so even though the grassroots left slate won many of the nominations in the nomination phase of that election, when they were getting nominations from people who were active in the party as to stand, they won them hands down in London overwhelmingly. But the election results were completely different, and that's because they'd fixed it in the way I just laid out with their monopoly of data, you know. So they won the CEC elections by fraudulent means. 14 seats for Corbyn's the many slate versus eight seats won by the grassroots left. And what they've done now is they've now rammed through extensive bans on dual membership. So what we have faced with now, that was done just before the election. They passed bans on dual membership. And one of the reasons why this event has been brought forward an hour is because there is a meeting after this at 5 o'clock, called by Mel Mullins, who is the leader of the left of your party, effectively the CEC member for London. She's called it at 5 o'clock to report on what's happening in today's CEC meeting. Well, I understand there'll be more attacks on the Marxist left. She's going to report on that this evening. But anyway, what's happened as in response to that is a comrade called Richard Gerrard, who was once the leader of Workers' Power, but he's now sort of independent Marxist, along with others, created a thing called the Members' Charter, which basically put an ultimatum to the CEC. So you better give up your monopoly of the data. You better, you know, democratise the organisation fundamentally. There's a whole range of demands. I can't go through all of them. But basically, if you don't do that by the 16th of May, I think it was, we're going to call a conference. But of course, their response to that, even as the election campaign was getting underway, their response was their prescription of the SWP and of a whole range of other Marxist groups. They prescribed them, you know. That was their response to the members' charter. So there is going to be a conference. And there have been two Zoom meetings already with over, well into three figures of activists, even in the middle of an election campaign, which I've decided to call a pre-conference online on the 31st of May. It will be a pre-conference with the objective of discussing exactly what format an organisation will take. There's a proposal for a socialist federation of some sort of activists, because there are a lot of activists. There are over 100 different proto-branches, possibly more. And the aim is to organise the people, the activists in those proto-branches into some sort of organisation with its own data and its own collectivity, basically. That will begin on the 31st of May, leading to a proper conference in September to found something something, whatever that something will be decided at the conference on the 31st of May, and it'll actually be founded in September. It's not a call for a split, but they may actually expel the supporters of the new Socialist Federation, or whatever it's called, or whatever it is. It's a body that aims to put things right by whatever means, and it won't just walk away from the conference. It will be a members organisation, a members association or something like that initially, not seeking a new party. But if they're forced to do that, we will do. You know, we're hoping that Rosara will be on board. Certain things have made me think that she probably will be, but she's got her own problems. As I said, there are over 100 proto-branches around the country. They've all been treated appallingly. They've been deprived of data. They do not have access to the data of the members who live in their own area, so they've been organising in the dark. We in Croydon had to organise Mel's election campaign in the dark without knowing who the members are. We're supposed to have 400 members in Croydon, but we're lucky to get a few dozen at meetings, because we don't know who the members are, and that's deliberate. That's Corbyn's tactics, you know. So there's a conference, another conference of what's called Your Party Connections on the 6th of June in Sheffield. It's not the same thing, though it may dovetail with that, and I'm thinking of going to that. The point of, you know, Your Party Connections is an informal network of proto-branches, basically. It wasn't set up as a rebellion against the leadership in the direct sense that the members' charter was. It was set up for practical reasons, but it's nevertheless important to get it on board. So I might well go to that. I have been playing a bit of a role in the volunteer group that's trying to get this conference together, but I've not been that active because I've been involved very much more heavily in Mel's election campaign, which I thought was more important in the immediate sense. But the point about this is that your party has become a laughingstock, and we won't just walk away without a determined attempt to salvage it, because its potential was huge. 800,000 people expressing a desire to be involved in a new socialist party is not something that happens every day. It's never happened before in my lifetime. And it's been deliberately squandered by Corbyn, and we're not just going to let that lie. You know, we're going to try and salvage it in whatever way we can. Thank you, comrades.
Thanks, Ian. I should point out that you mentioned connections, but in case comrades don't know, connections actually existed before your party. Like what some people claim, it actually pre-existed your party. It's only now that some people have tried to pretend it's a your party organisation, but it never was that way. But people like Channel 4 tried to claim that it's a your party organisation, but of course it never was. I'm a bit sceptical personally about connections. I've got more faith in the charter, but that's a personal view. Anyhow, comrades, we are limited for time, but thank you. Who wants to come in on this item?
I do want to say about Transform. Didn't they all quit and join your party and donate the monies they had? Mm-hmm. Ian? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and they were talking about who was trying to get their hands on that. Any more information come out about the backroom boys and girls, apart from obviously Carrie Murphy and Len McCluskey and James Snyder? You know, because they were they are part of the, there seem to be connections between them and the McSweeney group who were linked to Mandelson.
I'd be very surprised.
Before you answer that, I just want to say, Mark, Can you meet now?
Yeah, I will, but I was going to get ready to ask a question.
Okay, I'll cut it short. Sorry, Mark.
Ian, do you want to answer that before Mark comes in?
Well, just in terms of McSweeney, I don't see any evidence of connections between McSweeney and anybody in your party. I think that's very unlikely, because those people are the enemies of Jeremy Corbyn from the right. They're the people who got rid of Corbyn, aren't they? They're not going to be. You know, that is a completely different ball game. That's.
I thought one of them was married.
Order, please. One at a time, please.
Yeah.
Ian, carry on.
I have never heard of any such connection, and I'd be very surprised if there was, because they hate Corbyn. They hate his guts. They destroyed him, basically. The problem is, let me just mute this. Hang on. I'm just muted Mark. Sorry, I've muted the wrong person. Oh, God. Have I?
No, Mark one was interfering.
I've done it now. Yeah, I've done it. Yeah. Okay, it's just that it was Mark's background noise was sort of chipping through or something, you know. But I've never heard of any connection between your party's right wing and the Labour right, because they're the enemies of each. They're mutually enemies, you know.
Forgive me, I think one of them is married to somebody who's in Starmer's cabinet group.
I've never heard of that. You might be right, but I've never heard of it, you know. But irrespective of that, I mean, you know, I don't think James Schneider is involved. He bailed out quite early, but it's Carrie Murphy, it's... what's his name? McCluskey is behind Carrie Murphy, of course. They're a team, you know. Even if he's not only formal on any committees, they act as a political team. And there's a whole range of these people who were in Unite's bureaucracy. James Schneider is an intellectual figure. I met him once. He's a different ball game. He's a slippery git. He was in Momentum and all that. But I think the main bulk of these people are the people who were in Lotto who were around McCluskey and Carrie Murphy. That's my understanding of it. To be honest, I don't really attach much significance to them. They're just the enemy, you know. They're the people who've wrecked the party, you know, and their behaviour is appalling, and the sooner we get rid of them in whatever way possible, the better. That's just my view to them, and we may well do so. Hopefully we will do so. There will be a fresh initiative, and hopefully we can actually outgrow Corbyn's bloody abortion of a thing, you know, because he deliberately aborted it. He deliberately sabotaged. You know, the most outrageous piece of sabotage, I think, was that second email on the 19th of September. That was a terrible blow. And there are some stupid people on the left who try to say both sides are as bad as each other. And that reminds me, the Weekly Worker was one. The Spartacist League of Britain also published crap that basically, you know, stupid denunciations that this was a shit show and both sides were to blame. No, they weren't. Zara Sultana made a good faith attempt to recruit those 800,000 people into the party against sabotage from Corbyn behind the scenes. She attempted it, and then they accused her of all sorts of terrible things to sabotage it. It wasn't a shit show. It was an attempt to do the right thing. And sometimes the left is stupid. You know, even the far left are stupid. And don't understand basic facts about reality of how an organisation is to be built. And that's one way, that was a serious attempt to, I'm not sure what's happening with your connection, Mark. But I did mute you because it was coming through somehow. It might be some sort of noise problem or electronic problem or something. But sometimes the left is really stupid about, you know, crude hostility to social democracy and the attempt, the view that they're all up to no good. Well, some of them are, and some of them aren't at a given time, you know. And just because Zara Sultana is an ex-Labour MP, actually a very young ex-Labour MP by Labour Party standards, doesn't mean that there's no difference between her and Corbyn, and the falling out was something cynical. It wasn't. It was a serious attempt to build an inclusive socialist, you know, working class party versus idiots and stupid people trying to sabotage it. That's being charitable, you know. I could think of worse things to say. But people who didn't want that to happen, who use their position and their authority in the Labour movement to sabotage it, which is terrible, and they should be branded for that, you know. Yeah, sorry.
Do you like the question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, it's actually going back to the original topic on the election results. Just a quick: is it not inevitable that reform will fail? I mean, not necessarily politically in one respect, because bigots always have a large constituency of support in this country, but we've had several months of failure from wannabe candidates who've turned out to be crooks at one level or very softly committed to the idea of reform. So what I'm saying is, isn't it likely that they will fail from within themselves anyway as soon as they get any sniff of power? Thanks.
Ian?
Well, if I'll come back on that, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really can't predict what will happen to them. I think they are not well organised. That's a fact. They have some real idiots in there that they promoted and then had to abandon an embarrassment, you know. But who knows, you know. Who knows what will be the final outcome of all that? Because, you know, Reform itself is a relatively new organisation. It was the Brexit Party. Farage abandoned one party, which is now led by a overtly fascist Mussolini fan who's goes around giving stiff arm salutes and whatever. He's actually Italian, Tenconi or whatever his name is. That's UKIP. UKIP still exists. Farage abandoned it and created another new party, because it wasn't suitable for his own doing. That was the Brexit Party, and I think the Brexit Party is basically Reform, you know. But it's not exactly an old party, and it's not a fascist party as such. But it has far right politics in many ways, and it's not a cadre fascist party. Some of these people are complete morons and idiots, and they couldn't organise a piss up in a brewery, but. I don't know. There's also Reclaim, of course, which is Rupert Lowe's party, which has actually done quite well in the election in Norfolk, apparently. You know, that's more overtly Nazi than Reform, but it's a lot smaller. You know, I don't know. I really don't know what will happen to Reform. It could. Some people have said its support has peaked already, and it's actually been a decline. Its approval rate. Its support was in the 30s for a brief period, and it's now in the mid 20s. But it could still just about form a government, given the peculiarities of the British electoral system. It might even get a majority. It's just about possible, you know. Which is why some people are talking about bringing in proportional representation before the next election. So they can't have a majority. Nobody can have a majority unless they actually get more than 50% of the popular vote, which is very unlikely in a multi-party British election. But I don't know. I don't know what will happen. But Reform is not... Reform is a right-wing populist party. Whether it will deter... I mean, you know, what's the name in Italy? What is the name of the Italian Prime Minister? I can't remember her name.
Meloni.
Pardon?
Isn't it Meloni?
Yeah, Meloni, yeah, yes. She's good got that pedigree, but she's been in power for about 3 or 4 years. And to be honest, I don't see her government as particularly terrifying. I've been to Italy, and I thought it doesn't look very different to many other places. You know, it doesn't look like it's exactly a fascist regime. You know, but I don't know. I don't know what it would be like, whether it will win the election, whether it will disintegrate, whether it will be a terrifying thing if it gets elected, or whether it will just collapse under its own incompetence. It may do so before the general election, because it's won a few councils. It may be totally discredited by then. I just don't know. Yeah.
Before I bring Jonathan, I just want to point out that Restore is Rupert Lowe's party. Reclaim,
yeah, you're right,
Lawrence Fox's party, which is even less irrelevant, I believe.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jonathan, and then Susan.
No, I think it's interesting that these parties like Restore and Reclaim and UKIP are being set up, because the ruling class obviously realise that reform won't do the job. I mean, Farage's politics won't do the job, really, you know. I mean, you just look at them. I mean, they do a very good job on immigrants, and but when it comes to cutting welfare and being serious about doing a sort of, in a way, like a Thatcherite job on Britain, you know, completely changing it for the ruling class, is quite clear. Not complete. She didn't completely change it, but she saw 3 million go up. I mean, you need an organisation that's going to be serious about attacking the impediments to capital in Britain, and Reform really aren't that party. I mean, they don't come out with the Daily Mail was criticising them when I used to read the Daily Mail for their economic incompetence, you know, their thing. But you know, what you need is, and this is the contradiction of it all. What you need is some organisation to come in that's going to be willing to cut things like tax credits, you know, people who get paid from the government and on their job, you know, and sort of, you know, serious people like this. But, you know, how are you going to do that democratically? How are you going to get someone elected on the basis of implementing huge cuts and reorganising British capital is the basic contradiction. And Farage, for all his anti-immigrant rhetoric, is pretty quiet about the stuff that needs to be done for British capital. And the ruling class realise that. I think Restore are a bit more serious about trying to deal with the problems of British capital but Farage, I can't really see that much future for reform. I mean, I can see them coming in and doing something pretty nasty about the immigrants and that, but their social base, you know, depends on welfare. So, you know, how you do that in a capitalist democracy, imperialist democracy, I don't know. Anyway, that's it.
Susan?
It's just to say, anyone know if Farage is still intent on getting rid of the House of Lords?
No idea.
No, I had a major ding-dong with somebody on the Crispin show this morning who was coming the I've been on this longer than you, and he just wants PR instead of first past the post. And I'm just saying, unless you get rid of the House of Lords, there is no point, you know, no matter how much you you can rejig the elections to be stop being first past the post and become PR, but it will not change the fact that the UK has no democracy because all the legislation is delayed or held up by, you know, the gentleman's club that is the House of Lords. And it's got a far bigger impact because of all the think tanks that are massively funded, whether it's, you know, Tony Blair's, I think he's got the biggest, the highest money pot for his think tank, hasn't he, in the country, and all the other think tanks that are busy drawing up all the laws and just generally undermining all the legislation. To me, it seems like it's a waste of time. We have to get rid of the House of Lords. And nobody is grasping that nettle at the moment.
Well, apart from Zara Sultana, who wants to get rid of the monarchy itself as well.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm with her on that one as well.
Yeah. That's another thing I forgot to mention in my rendition of her policies. Getting rid of the monarchy was caused outrage amongst some of the Corbynites. Oh, you'd be unelectable if you say that.
Oh, yeah. They're so obsessed with how electable they are.
Let's not have too much to-ing and fro-ing.
Can I just come in a minute?
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to say you're right, actually, about the it's not reclaim. That's the party of an idiot called Lawrence Fox, who used to be the husband of Billy Piper, famous actress of various descriptions, including on Doctor Who. But he's an idiot. He got arrested for some indecent thing or something quite recently. He's a complete fool. The Reclaim is his party. There's Restore Britain, which is Rupert Lowe, who's a serious fascist and a very unpleasant character, but thankfully he's a lot smaller than Farage's party. And of course there's Farage's party, which is Reform, you know. But it does get confusing. There's so many idiots around with their own right wing party. It's easy to get confused. And that's just part of the climate of right-wing populism, you know. I think Rupert Lowe is the most serious and sinister individual, but anyway, what else was I going to say? Abolishing the House of Lords is a democratic demand, and it's certainly, along with abolishing the monarchy, they are crucial for a socialist party to have as its policies, and it's not really worthy of it. You know, what did Trotsky say in the 20s about, you know, that these people who talk about socialism on the Labour left, they won't even deprive the Prince of Wales of his pocket money or something like that, you know. That was Trotsky in Where Is Britain Going? And it's still the case. The Corbynites whinging about, oh, this policy will make us unpopular, you know. You can't attack the monarchy. Even if the king, even though the king's brother is a fucking Epstein sex offender, you know, you still can't attack the bloody monarchy, you know. It's unbelievable, you know. The cretinism that's in British social democracy. And they react with, you know, such opportunist, you know, appalling politics. If you say, you can't do this because it will upset the working class and we're all royalists. And, well, is that true? If it is true, then it has to be changed. You have to tell people that they're stupid and they're deluded or whatever, and actually change the policy and change the ideological outlook of the Labour movement. And if you can't do that, you're just tailing after the backward consciousness and not doing anything to make things better, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I think Charles and Miller are as firmly entrenched in the Epstein classes, Andrew and the rest of the Fergusons. And I think people are going soft on them because they don't want to rock the boat, whereas in reality, Charles has been surrounded by overt and blatant paedophiles from Mountbatten to Jimmy Savile to, I forget about the rest of them, but the reality is they've bailed out and known about it, and they've connived with the sheer number of sex trafficking that was going on and ignored the security issues and the misuse of, you know, in America, they're all obsessed with the sex trafficking. In Britain, they're trying to try Andrew and Mandelson on misconduct in public office. But the truth is, it stretches on both ways, and it is entirely about it. But the crassness, which is appointing Andrew as trade envoy, Mandelson, you know, these are all Zionists working for the Zionist cause, and they are not doing anything for Britain, but they are how we keep it going. But the thing with Meloni is Italians have just been caught in the attempted coup on Mali that has resulted in this fiasco of tens of thousands of terrorists, as well as a massive corruption plight in on the borders. You know, Kidal is the place that's just being decimated now because of the crimes that they committed there. But it's been, you know, there is a NATO, because it's France, Germany and Italy and Ukraine all going to attack Africa, and they are trying to, remove the Sahel countries, again, because this is geopolitics trying to control the gold and uranium. Yeah, and this is resources, and how important it is, because the media are covering none of it. So geopolitics has got to start looking at this being a, you know, this is the fight, as far as twats like Hexith to call it, you know, the fight between the warriors of light and darkness. They're trying to sell, you know, the Zionist people are trying to sell it as light v dark. And if you listen to some of the more insane people on, you know, in Israel, it really is. But it still comes down to, these are people who are fighting. We're using our money, using the vast amounts of money that they are doing. And it's just acts of piracy. What possesses Starmer to think he can just, you know, attack another Russian oil tanker as it's going through, and that there won't be repercussions? And they don't print them. But it's still going to come down to, we are going to pay the price for him supporting Israel and cracking down on Palestine Action, cracking down on anyone who protests. You know, the Hugger Nazi that you're seeing in Number 10 and in, Windsor Castle or wherever he's, you know, wherever Charles is meeting. Charles going to address Congress. Blatant corruption of what's no longer a constitutional monarchy. Nobody allowed
We're going a bit off topic here, because we were on the topic of local elections. Ian, do you want to come back on that before I come in?
Not particularly. You come in.
On the question of local elections, I'm seeing reports in various WhatsApp groups, so I saw one the other day. I haven't really been following the results, to be honest. But there is some annoyance with the Green Party, because in some areas I get the impression that we're seeing a replay of what kind of happened in 2024 general election, when in, say, 11 constituencies, it was arguable that certain socialist independents could have won had the Greens not stood. And I believe in some areas that phenomenon has happened again. Can you confirm whether that's the case or not?
Oh. Can you repeat the question? Sorry.
I was saying that there were debates about whether, in some areas, whether it is the case that the Greens just split the vote, and in effect they've stopped socialist candidates from winning because the Green Party split the vote. Can you confirm that that is the case?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is, yes. I mean, but
I believe Camden was unique because the Greens did actually have an agreement with Camden Independent to stand aside, didn't they? And they've actually won a seat.
Yeah, I believe there was. Yeah.
Apologies.
Does anyone have any further questions on the question of local elections?
Is there any information on how many councils did not hold elections who should have done? Because I know that Starmer had allowed quite a few councils where they were at risk not to hold elections, weren't there?
Cause... No, I thought that was defeated in court.
Yes and no. I mean, my area was clearly being rejigged in Oxfordshire because it looked like Oxfordshire was going to have elections next year and under a new reorganised unitary authority arrangement. So there were some areas that was, I think there was a defeat in court around that, but I don't know the precise details. But some reorganisations are clearly still going ahead. Otherwise, my own area would have been up for grabs if that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. But I think we've got elections next year. I'm not really, because at the moment we've got Oxfordshire County Council, and then we've got Oxford City Council and other district councils around the county, but that's all been rejigged. Okay. And so I think we've got elections next year, but Ian, do you know the answer to Susan's question or not?
Not really, no.
We've got 20 minutes.
I suggest we wind up unless there's any major other points, because we do have to prepare for the meeting itself, the Mel Mullins meeting, which is...
Is anyone invited to that?
I think...
Ian, or just...
I sent out a link, didn't I? Did I send it to everybody?
Well, I've got it in the WhatsApp.
Yeah, I think... I think anybody who's a member of your party can go along. Right.
Did you notice how defensive Louise Regan was over my comment about that the elected CEC was a rubber stamp for the think tank that's currently drawing up all the paperwork, shall we say, for your party?
I didn't see that. To be honest, I was
I think what I'll do is I'll make a final call for questions, and so are there any further questions? In which case, can't see any, so I'll make the final summing up and then we'll click off the recording. Okay, comrades, it's been a very good discussion. Thank you all for coming. Consistent Democrats will be meeting at some point next week, and we'll be discussing about what we discuss next time. So those of you on the mailing list will get an email in due course. And so thank you all for coming, and now we can click off the recording. Thanks, comrades.
Okay.